I do not know if this kind of miracle cure happens often with appendicitis cases, and nothing was ever said about it again at home, from what I can remember, so perhaps it does. EATMD forgotten about it until I began putting all this together a few years ago. That is not the only unusual thing I can remember about childhood and sickness, though. All my cousins had the usual run-ins with viruses, mumps, chickenpox, measles and so on, and as was customary at the time I was dumped in to get it over and done with. It was expected that all children would catch these bugs sooner or later, sooner being better than later, I believe. Just to be different, I caught none of them. The legend. According to my hosts, their history spans many millions of years. However, as I already suggested, having studied some of their records, there is a span time of unknown length in which some details are missing. A very interesting legend has grown up around the fragments of historical fact that these people do have of that missing time period. This legend reaches across the vastness of space and touches our own history on this planet Earth. Strangely enough, their original planet went by the name of Kyber, but it was originally the fourth planet from our sun. This was before the arrival of Venus into our system. Kyber orbited in a slightly elliptical manner outside the orbit of the planet Mars. It was predominantly a watery planet, smaller than but not unlike the Earth in most respects. The water was mostly frozen, as Kyber was much further from our sun than the Earth. In its elliptical orbit, in some stages it would get almost as close to the sun as Mars, and we must remember that the sun was just a little hotter in those early days. The land masses along the equatorial regions at these times of the year were quite conducive to life as we would recognize it. At other times, these same life forms that had been seeded upon this planet would simply go underground. Some hibernated, while others used the planet's natural resources, such as thermal heat, to keep themselves warm. After a while, some of this life forms hardly ever came to the surface. There was no need to, as they had constructed huge underground bases with all the comforts of home. Because of this, two distinct races eventually emerged. Both were intelligent but had very little to do with each other. The surface race, if you could call them that, preferred to live the simple life. Even though they were very intelligent by Earth standards, they shunned technology altogether, opting to live in complete harmony with nature. If you didn't attempt to know where to look for them, you would think they would not exist at all. They were so attuned to nature that they developed what we would call psychic abilities. Their outward appearance would be considered primitive by Earth standards, in that they had a somewhat hairy or furry outer cover to protect themselves from the cold. The other race was almost the complete opposite. These beings, too, were highly intelligent, but they were also technologically advanced, a necessity due to their living underground. They became a race smaller in stature and more delicate than the surface dwellers, and after eons of time they ended up with no body hair at all. If you saw the two races together, you wouldn't think for one moment that they were direct relatives. The only really obvious common traits were that they both had two arms, two legs, and a head. Yes, just like us. It was the more inquisitive, subterranean group that discovered space travel, but this was when everything started to become undone for them. Their first step in space exploration was to one of Kyber Atm's moons, and in due course they visited all three moons. They later turned the moons into 8 space stations Atm, with the intention of using at least one of them at some future date as a vessel to colonize the far, distant stars. At about this time, they were conducting experiments on the planet itself to do with travel of a slightly different nature, dimensional travel. Somewhere along the way, something went terribly wrong with experiments and the planet Kyber was totally destroyed. However, the subterranean group which caused this catastrophe did have warning of what was about to happen, enough time to launch a ship to one of their moons before the planet was lost to them. On this ship they took with them a group of the hairy surface dwellers and several other life forms that lived beneath Kyber Atm's abundant but cold waters. The subterranean beings acknowledged their responsibility to the other life forms of their planet and tried their best to save as many as they could, perhaps in a scenario that somewhat parallels our own story of Noah TMS arc. On arrival at the moon or moon station, they hastily finished converting it into a spacecraft. They then used this most unusual vehicle to travel the relatively short distance to their nearest neighbor, the planet Mars. And so it was that Mars inherited a second moon. At this time in our solar system TMS history, Mars had an atmosphere and water, but the destruction of the planet Kuiper and the subsequent after effects were to spell the end of the Martian atmosphere. This was a gradual process taking many thousands of years, but eventually, as we all now know, much of that atmosphere was lost. However, even to this day, a large volume of the red planet TMS water remains frozen beneath the surface, waiting to be used. In the ensuing period, both humanoid groups lived side by side on the planet, while the aquatic types lived in the Martian seas. However, these entities knew they would have to find a more permanent home sooner or later. There was one obvious choice: planet Earth and its moon. The hairy and aquatic beings were given the chance to settle Earth first, as they were more suited to the prevailing conditions. The smaller, subterranean entities used the Earth TMS moon as their home base. Over time, they improved their space technology enough to be able to go wherever they chose. A small group of them remained on Mars but was forced to live underground. This was not really a hardship for them, as it was the way of their ancestors. This small group, I understand, is still living on Mars. Eventually one of the subterranean splinter groups returned to settle on Earth, my recurring dream. At first, these beings chose the colder areas of this planet, the North and South Polar regions, where they still have underground or underwater bases today. But they were also using other areas, as they still are, much to the consternation of some regimes that would call themselves the unelected leaders of planet Earth. As I listened to this fascinating legend, and remember, at this time it was only a legend, I felt like butting in with some small additions from my own dream. How could that dream of mine fit so well into a story I had never heard before? The universe is truly a mysterious place. Chapter 15. An Alien Among Friends. My first introduction to one of Xena TMS closest friends was to one who went by the name Maharishi. Maharishi, also female, was slightly shorter than Xena, as they all seemed to be, but only by an inch or so. Maharishi worked for the recently formed Hydroponics Laboratories, as close as I can describe it, which was created as a contingency plan in case solid food became necessary for their experimental offspring in the various breeding programs underway. It was interesting to hear what Maharishi felt about Xena TMS volunteering for the above program. I am sure Xena has calculated everything out very carefully. She always does. I had the same courage, she added. I should really be on it, too. I probably will, once we see how Xena gets on. Her second friend was male, although, once again, shorter than Xena. He was of more help as he worked on a portion of the breeding program. When Xena was otherwise engaged, I spent every spare moment pumping him for information on the project. Even though he was hesitant at first, when I explained I could possibly be introduced into some part of the experiment, he did give me some reassurance. My part would involve no risk at all. He did admit though that they were running out of ideas to speed up the development of a stronger race. He, TMS he because I can't TMT remember his name, seemed a nervous enough sort, anyhow, always twiddling his long fingers or playing with his liquid dispenser. He kept looking around the room as if trying to find someone. His long neck rather reminded me of a giraffe trying to look over a high fence at the zoo. His head seemed a little bigger in proportion than most. Anyway, I wondered to myself if he had problems holding it up. I had to be very careful that none of these thoughts slipped out as I conversed with him. I was amazed at how nonchalant the crowded entertainment area was about having an alien, namely me, in their midst. Their contact with the likes of Millie must have made me old news. Some very curious to know, of all things, how we managed to tolerate such short day, night periods on Earth. and with our having to sleep a third of it away as well, they seemed to be of the opinion we wouldn't TMT have time to get anything done. Others could not comprehend the enormous population growth on our planet. I explained that the country I came from on Earth was sparsely populated by world standards. This seemed to make them even more confused. I had to confess I had no answers. Yeah, sure, I could see their estimation of Earthlings fall by the minute, and who could blame them? I pumped Mahirishi as much as I could for information about Xena. Their bigger immediate concern was that no one was sure how long the new breed, like Mahirishi and Xena, would live. There was concern that any quickening of development, such as in the direction they were presently going, could severely reduce their life expectancy, not to mention their mental powers. This is what was holding back development at this point. Only now did they realize that any more delay could spell the extinction of their race. Xena had always been near the top of her classes. "You should have seen her," said Mahirishi, arguing with her tutors, never accepting anything unless they could prove it right in front of her. Then she would spend the rest of her spare time trying to come up with another better way of doing something, just to annoy them. "Sounds familiar," I thought to myself. As Xena progressed through her schooling and continued to outstrip the other students around her, she was carving an inevitable path toward her involvement in the Earth relocation plans. Even though all major decisions were, and still are, made by the elders, it was obvious they themselves would never be able to settle on Earth and would have to make way for the new generation that existed, or would exist in the near future. Xena TM's first and only trip to Earth had occurred approximately 1 year before this adventure of mine. This second trip had been to test her abilities aboard ship, at exactly what, I was not told. Eventually her friends left, and we were alone with Jars and Thress. A rather enjoyable chat ensued, the first time I had been with them without something else going on. If you could call a mind, link transference a chat. For all their imposing appearance and intelligence, they were easy to get on with, asking me details of my life on Earth and events leading up to my appearance in the transporter, details that up until then I had not even discussed with Xena. They were indeed a gentle and understanding race. I couldn't TMT help but feel that the Earth would be a better place for having them, even without the wealth of technical information they would bring. Every moment I spent with these people was weakening my desire to return home. We talked on through the night. Xena and I were planning to leave on our coastal trip at first light so as not to waste any of our last half day together. Xena and I decided to push off in her boat, and sit and contemplate our fate as the sun slowly rose above the lazy, looking Haven Sea. I only hoped that by the time Haven at TMS Sun finally did its thing, Xena TMS people, perhaps just the next generation of them, would be far away on Earth or some other planet they might yet find. In spite of these thoughts, it was pleasant sitting out on the water, listening to the gentle clink of the wavelets on the side of the boat as a soft, warm breeze started to ruffle the water around us. We were only 100 meters or so from the shoreline, but it may as well have been a nautical mile as we both sat back with our own thoughts. "Better get started," Xena said, breaking the silence, "if we are going to get any distance down the coast this morning." I would have been quite happy to stay out there all day. Chapter 16. Last Memories. The car was set on automatic mode. Evidently these vehicles are not meant to be used on the manual setting, but that didn't TMT stop us the day before. Xena had let me have a go, knowing my love for fast cars. "How does it compare to your Earth machines?" she asked. "Do you know of one of our expressions, 8 McCork and cheese?" I asked in return. She replied. "Well, we drive a lot of chalk back home," I suggested. We both laughed. The sea brought back memories of when she, Mahirishi and another friend, Myron, had set themselves the task of traversing an arm of their local sea, a distance of approximately 1,000 nautical miles to the nearest land, save for a few small islands. This was to be done without the help of any external power source, and with their mind, power alone. The idea ran into trouble almost before they started, When Maharishi discovered after just half a diet EMS traveled that she was prone to seasickness, they had allowed 5 days for the trip. Secondly, the boat started to leak, and in their over-exuberant attempts to repair it they made it worse. Such is the nature of plastic boats. This rather interesting adventure took place when Zina was 15 years old. Like all teenagers, they knew everything and had all angles covered, or so they thought. They spent the first night trying to stop the boat from sinking, with Maharishi trying to stop herself from feeling she was going to die. They eventually made it to a small island but were determined not to ask for help, as both sets of parents had told them not to go. I hope one day you will get to read Zina TMS whole hilarious adventure from Alika TMS book, and find out how the crossing of the sea went. As we left the developed areas behind, the coastline became more natural in appearance. I asked Zina to stop at the first beach we came to, as, apart from the desert, I had not seen anything else on the planet that was not artificial or Aitman made. ATM I was eager to explore. We duly stopped and got out onto a grass verge. The grass, or the like, ran down to the beach line. The coastline itself was very rocky, but on the beach there was sand. Brown in color, very fine, and nice to walk on. We sat on it after a short time of my poking around just up from the water at EMS edge. It was great just to sit there. We didn't EMT have to say much. The sound of the sea lapping up the beach soothed the two of us, I am sure. I knew we both felt a little sad. It rather reminded me of school holidays long ago, when, for all the fun that was to be had, the last day or two always lost its gloss because you knew it would end soon. I wasn't TMT too sure, but I thought I caught sight of a deer in Zina TMSI. I know there was one on mine as I looked off in another direction. We were as different as the chalk and cheese metaphor I had used a few miles before. That a TMS an interesting peninsula just up ahead, I said. Do we have time to take a closer look? I should think so, Zina replied. We left the beach and walked back to the car. It did not take us long to reach the peninsula. I had acclimatized to the haven gravity, but it was still difficult for me to downgrade some of my movements. I could almost have jumped to the top of the rock face, but held back just in case Zina needed a hand. She was more precious to me than gold. Speaking of gold, it looked like that was what I had found. Zina set me straight. It is iron sulfide which has been crystallized. That makes it look like gold. No need to pick at it, Alec. I have some at home that you may have. These crystals were the two I later found in my car after the long drive home. The only things I know about that came home with me. I continued my exploration of the stream itself, right to the point where it exited the plateau in a small but exquisite waterfall. Some of the more sheltered side, shoots of the stream still had ice in them, so this gives an idea just how cold it got at night. Our time was up, and we had to rush to get back to the city for our appointments, for there were still a few small tests we both had to undergo. I would be leaving that night and needed to report in several hours beforehand. Zina had earlier told me that, as with all newborn experimental babies, her child would be put into simulated Earth-type conditions as soon as practicable after she or he was born. If the tests were encouraging, the baby would then be transported to Earth for further tests. If I knew Zina, she would not be far away and would probably insist on accompanying her child to Earth. I suggested she call in for a coffee as they passed overhead. That was worth a laugh. Chapter 17. The Return. Alone in my room later on, I was examining the rock samples I had collected out in the desert. My initial cursory inspection suggested these were samples of glazed pottery, but I realized on closer examination that the samples exhibited all the characteristics of a plastic material. Most rock or stone is cold to the touch, but this material had a rather warm feel to it, more in keeping with an insulator. I thought some of the samples worth hanging on to. EATMM no geologist, but EATMD never seen anything like it on Earth. As I sat in my room, I reached another conclusion, but it was not a happy one. I wondered if this material could be the residue of annihilation. Could artificial structures, made from this material, once have existed out in that desert area and been destroyed in some holocaust so catastrophic that their only remnants were the shrapnel, like pieces I had picked up out there? I remember Zena saying that the Great Rift Canyon was created in a monumental earthquake around the time of some of their early dimensional experiments, but I was puzzled. Had there been more to the desert trip than just sightseeing? Zena had gone out of her way to show me this area of land, but she had not exactly elaborated on any major catastrophe. Was I reading something into this that she had not really intended? Somehow she TMD already known of my interest in rock pounding, so had she been hoping that my interest would help me discover these catastrophic facts accidentally after she had pointed me in the right direction? But what facts were they? If annihilation had indeed occurred, what was the message? Could this be the future fate of planet Earth? Why had she not just come out with it? I was still not entirely sure why they had singled me out from 5.5 billion other Earthlings. Zena would not answer that question for me, but kept on insisting I would be capable of answering most of my own questions in due course. In any case, once I became truly involved in the complexities of the breeding program, some of those answers came blatantly obvious. My thoughts now turned in this direction. Soon, my rather beautiful golden bodysuit would have to be removed and replaced with the blue version, a procedure that had been performed under controlled conditions in an underground laboratory. Zena had let it slip earlier that the gold coloring was a reflection of the fairly high gold content. I remember commenting at the time that perhaps I could take one home with me. Many people back on Earth believe that gold worn next to the skin is beneficial for health and well-being, but I know there was much more to the Haven suits than this. I have found that gold leaf not only conveniently absorbs blue and violet light, but its texture surface strongly reflects yellow and red, hence its color. Curiously, this then leaves us with the green sector of the spectrum, which is neither absorbed nor reflected. This might suggest that if a suit could be designed to incorporate a thin gold compound, it would have all the necessary properties to make a great UV sunscreen, heat reflector or insulator, with possible inbuilt health benefits as well, and all this while letting in the gentler solar rays. The second type of bodysuit, the blue one worn on board the transporter, is an even deeper mystery to me. Lapis lazuli, the stone that was held in high regard by the pharaohs of ancient Egypt, is also blue. I have seen several photographs of ancient Egyptian wall paintings that depict people who appear to be entirely blue in color. As most Egyptian art is representative of people's daily lives, I would consider it very unusual for the Egyptians to have drawn such figures in this color if they had not been trying to represent something that they regarded as familiar or had seen in the past. Whatever reason these alien people had for their past interactions with Earth races, they could not have been more important than the reasons they have for interacting with us now. Their aims with their breeding programs were never going to be easy to achieve, complicated as they were by the lack of compatible donors from our side. It could just as easily have been any other male from our planet to fit the bill, except the real problem was the rarity of compatible males. Evidently, it did not seem to matter if a female from our planet was not entirely compatible, provided that she was utilized a TM only the one time, curiously enough. If compatible in all aspects, she could be involved more than that one time as a foster mother. I do not know the reasons for this. The male was a different story and had to be right on every count. Bruce Cathy may have unwittingly touched on this subject in his latest book, The Harmonic Conquest of Space, Nexus Publishing, 1995. If you are at all curious about the technical aspects of harmonics, space and the Earth grid system, I recommend you read this book. After quoting a paragraph from Bruce Cathy's TMS book, Alec continues, add to that the vagaries of A, negative blood, and how many are there from whom to choose. I began to see the importance of my childhood interactions, being singled out at an early age and nurtured simply because there were so few of us that they wanted to be sure we were available when needed. There was no coincidence or luck involved in my abduction, it would seem. They knew all about me, even before I was taken aboard. The clinical precision and long-term planning of this operation made me think they would not tolerate for long the buffoonery of the human race back home on Earth. I decided that if they did arrive on our doorstep one day, life on Earth was going to be very interesting. My final hours on Haven went by very quickly, and before I knew it we were on our way to the transporter terminal. Xena had accompanied me so that we could say our last goodbyes. Our last trip together was indeed a somber affair. But this time I knew there might be future opportunities for space travel, time travel or both, possibly the dream of half the population of Earth. It was a strange turn of events. I felt like I was leaving home, not returning to it. The act of leaving was more emotional for me than I could possibly have imagined just a few days before. Some of the happenings immediately prior to this final act on alien soil had rather taken me by surprise. Perhaps one day, when experiences such as mine are no longer considered controversial, and ridicule does not flow so readily from non-believers at EM lips, I may summon the courage to tell you the complete story of my adventure. I could hardly believe that just 6 or 7 Earth days had passed since my involuntary induction into the Haven transporter and my meeting up with Xena. I was saying goodbye to the most important part of the adventure, standing before me standing in the guise of a 4-foot-10-inch alien. An exquisite creature in every way, there was nothing more certain than the fact that I would never again meet anyone quite like her in my lifetime. We had already said all there was to say, so we just stood there and let the silence say the rest. Finally, I turned and entered the building where I was to be fitted with my new blue new suit. I knew that Xena would be watching me as I walked out onto the flat field in front of the transporter, and would keep watching until the transporter eventually disappeared from sight. My eyes were more than a little damp, but I could not bear to look back. I entered the transporter as quickly as possible so as to not be tempted. Now there was no turning back. I was going home. Once on board, the few things that I had been able to bring with me were placed in my sleeping area. Not that I would use it for sleep, but it was a place I felt was my own private space. As I was making my way to this area, Xena TM's last few puzzling words were still uppermost in my mind. Forget the abomination you have seen here. When you get home, with all caution and common sense, let the sun see your eyes. In spite of what others may say, do not hide yourself from a friend. I am not sure whether this was the same craft I had arrived in, but it looked identical with the same arrowhead, type insignia above the entranceway. Alec explains more about this insignia at this point in his book. We did not depart immediately. However, my judgment of the passage of time had been affected throughout this interaction. I had no timepiece or even a frame of reference. In other words, they did not ring a dinner gong every few hours. Eventually there was a gentle bump, and the next moment we were well above the city. We were out of the atmosphere in what seemed only a few seconds. I watched until Haven and its oversized moon were fast, disappearing dots. A few hours later, so was their sun. There was a slight surge in gravity, then it eased off. Before I left Haven, Xena had given me a severe lecture about the dangers of dehydration with this particular form of travel and had told me to have liquid at regular periods, whether I felt the need or not. I was hoping I would now have the opportunity to interact with some of the crew members, if only they would communicate with me. There was still much I did not TMT know about this form of travel and I was about to try to remedy that. The thing I most wanted to do was to get a look at the control room, if they had such a thing. I realized this was going to be a fairly tall order unless I could get in with someone who had some clout. Eventually I came across Yarvity. Was also a hybrid, I guess. At least he was similar in appearance to Xena. This was his fourth trip to our time sector, as he put it, and I had many questions for him. Some of the answers were complex in the extreme and there is every possibility I have misinterpreted some of the answers. Still, I feel it is an interesting field of study for us here on Earth, and worthy of including at this point rather than leaving it out just because I may have misunderstood a small portion. If you have made mistakes in the past, and you can time travel, why don't you TMT you go back and correct them? I asked. That could be an even greater mistake, he replied, for then you would have no control over your eternal time.